Ah, Chicago. There's still no Latino mayoral candidate for Chicago. There are many black candidates. The better to split the opposition to Mayor Rahm Emanuel and their white candidates, but no Latino candidate. And that's even though Latinos make up a huge chunk, let's say 17% of the vote, maybe, in Chicago. There's no Latino candidate. Rahm's got to like that. But never fear. The leader of the Latino caucus in the Chicago City Council has a plan. Pigeons and pigeon racing. Pigeon racing is a sport that receives no attention in the United States, but is deeply loved in Poland, said Alderman Gilbert Villegas in a statement reported by the Chicago Tribune's John Byrne. A number of residents in my ward have brought that love of pigeons to their new country and would like to bring the sport to Chicago. Now, Villegas is the boss of the Latino caucus, and you'd think he'd spend his time trying to find a Latino candidate rather than appease the few remaining Polish immigrants in his ward with some kind of pigeon cartel. Pigeons crap all over your car. And if you're wearing a suit, man or woman, you know what'll happen. You knot that tie, check yourself out in the mirror, walk outside, and you hear the whoosh of pigeons. So we got pigeons. And happy Polish people, courtesy of a Latino alderman. But no Latino candidate? I think Rahm would rather that all Latinos play with pigeons than politics. See, jefe? Because Rahm is the Latino candidate. He's the mayor of the sanctuary city. And the ID cards for citizens and non-citizens alike. He's Mayor Zorro. Zorro the Fox. So cunning and free. Rahm's so cunning that with the help of his meat puppets in the city council, he stopped former Governor Pat Quinn from putting a referendum on the ballot, limiting a mayor to 2 terms. Rahm's meat puppets instead put non-binding referendums on the ballot to push Quinn's referendum off. One of these has to do with marijuana sales for schools. Yeah, should schools get revenue from marijuana sales? There's another one, a tax cut for people making $100,000 or more. And there's one about plastic straws because everybody needs an advisory referendum on plastic straws. But doesn't the city need a referendum on pigeon poops too, Alderman Villegas? Doesn't the city need a referendum on the lack of a Latino candidate in a city where 17% of the vote is Latino? Or do we just ignore that and watch the pigeons go round and round? We've got plenty to talk about. There's that left-wing hysteria over the vacancy in the Supreme Court. And I do hope somebody's going to get meds to Whoopi Goldberg and Joy Behar.
I got a little problem with that. You got a problem. You don't want people to take your guns. Well, get out of my behind. Get out of my vagina. Get out.
Come on, ladies. You're scaring the kids. The court's Janus decision and how that really impacts whether Governor Bruce Rauner can make a real campaign for governor. We'll talk about that with John Tillman, CEO of the Conservative Illinois Policy Institute. They pushed Janus. And then we'll talk it out with Pat Brady, a Rauner supporter, former Republican chairman and founder of Next Generation Strategies. Pat also used to be Dan Prof's golf partner. I don't think they do much golfing now. As always, co-host Jeff Carlin is here from WGN Radio, dropping in the Whoopi Goldberg and other sounds. And I'm John Cass, husband, father, syndicated columnist at the Chicago Tribune, gentle gardener, and the conservative standing on a little sugar cookie in a sea of liberal milk. And this is the Chicago way.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand with pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
This is John Cass on the Chicago Way, and with us, Pat Brady, chairman, former chairman of the Republican Party, former golf partner of Dan Proft, also chairman and founder of Next Generation Strategies, and a man steadfast in his support of one Bruce Rauner. And of course, always, there's Jeff Carlin from WGN Radio, a producer of the Rokan and Anna DeVellante show. Gentlemen, I have to ask you, now that the Supreme Court ruled in the favor of freedom, Janus is now the law, and the public sector unions can no longer coerce money from non-union members in order for them to keep their jobs. What does this mean for Bruce Rauner?
I think first and foremost, if you saw the headlines in the last couple of days, the headlines of virtually every major newspaper in the state say
The best one was on Sunday before it happened.
Yeah, Rauner, big victory for Rauner.
Yeah.
You wrote a column about it. So I think it's a big win for the governor and his reform agenda to get through the reforms that the state needs to get back on the right track. And this is, I read the decision, the Janus decision. It was based on First Amendment grounds that unions cannot make people join their union because it violates their First Amendment free speech rights. But I think, too, you need to remember the history of this, that Rod Blagojevich, the governor or former governor sitting in jail now, basically 10 years ago, 12 years ago, told everybody that wasn't in the union, you will never get a raise unless you join the union. If you join the union, you'll get a 4% raise, and then the unions support Rod Blagojevich at election time. So it's inherent conflict of interest. So it's a big victory for the First Amendment. It's a big victory for taxpayers.
Justice Anthony Kennedy, who resigned or retired and turned the entire Democratic media complex into hysterics. Whoopi Goldberg started crying. Schumer started crying.
This is for a Reagan appointment.
Right. For a Reagan appointment that they all hated and said would. But Kennedy supported free speech. He was a big free speech proponent, and he also supported gay marriage and supported Roe v. Wade. A conservative president nominated him.
Right.
Now we're going to go into the next round. What do you think?
I think that President Trump has every right and should appoint a conservative justice. He won the election. The Republicans control the Senate and they control the House. The people have spoken. This is to hear the Democrats whining about this now. Elections have consequences. And
who said that?
I think
Barack Obama.
Barack Obama said that. And to my Democrat friends, don't put up a rotten candidate like Hillary Clinton, and maybe you'll beat somebody that was easily beatable as Donald Trump. Donald Trump probably would have been by a better candidate. But the point is, he should, in my opinion, I'd like to see a Neil Gorsuch-type appointment again, somebody that strictly interprets the Constitution, doesn't create law like was done in the 60s and the 70s by those activist courts. So this is a tremendous opportunity for the president and for all the conservatives that voted for him because they wanted this to get done. They're going to get it done.
I think it's a huge, huge thing. Huge.
Oh,
but
it's funny, though, to listen to Alan Dershowitz. He was on Roe's show the other day explaining how the Supreme Court opinions really don't impact most Americans. And I'm like, well, what about Brown versus Board of Education, Roe versus Wade,
right,
Matt versus Ohio, Gideon versus Wainwright, all these cases that directly impact a whole lot of people.
As a lawyer, I must ask you, and I'm not a lawyer, but it bothers me.
I just went because I got three more spring breaks.
Yeah, no, you're a good lawyer. Nobody, you were a federal prosecutor and a state prosecutor, so you know the law. What bothers me is the left couldn't get all their left-wing agenda through the legislatures.
Sure.
They couldn't get it through Congress. They got it through the court. And they've turned this...
Or executive order.
Executive order, because, you know, Obama.
Yeah.
He said, I have a pen and a phone, and that's all you need, because I'm the king. What bothers me is that they've turned the debate into the Supreme Court should give us what we want, rather than the Supreme Court, their job is to read the Constitution and apply it, not as a Republican or a Democrat, but read what's in the Constitution and just don't make stuff up.
And that's the argument, and that's the difference between conservatives like me and you and liberals. Liberals think the court needs to be activist. In the 60s, when they went through that whole era of substantive due process, they're making up Roe versus Wade, no matter how you feel about abortion. That decision,
it's a bad decision.
Go back and read it. And I probably had to read it 30 times in the course of undergrad and law school. It is such tortured logic to get where they got to create this right of privacy. I'm not saying that there isn't that right, but it certainly wasn't the way they came up with it.
It wasn't written into the... See, my thing is...
Well, they took a whole bunch of cases,
yeah.
Griswold versus Connecticut, all this stuff, and came up with this, and they called it the penumbra.
Yeah.
But there is...
It was a political deal.
There are certain... I believe in that strict interpretation, but there are not everything is explicitly written, but you have to interpret or apply the law based on what is written.
There's nothing written in the Constitution that says 60, 70 million babies can be killed. I'm sorry. There's nothing. And there's nothing in the Constitution that says if your side wins elections, we're going to have the court do what we want. All you have to do, if you want to, all the people, and you're one of them, and you know better, but I respect you and like you, plus you're funny, is that if you're really terrified of somebody like Donald Trump, then you should want originalist justices on the Supreme Court because the Constitution protects you. But see, the left didn't care. They just wanted, what can we get? And we had a guy named Obama who didn't care, and all he had was his pen and his phone, and he would just make the law like a king. And that is the danger. Just because he's a smoothie and a silky doesn't make the man less autocratic.
No, and to me, I just have a different worldview on how government should run. And they believe in the activist courts. They believe that the government should be the tell you what kind of light bulbs you can buy and how you should live your life. I just don't feel that way. And that's why it goes back to you strictly interpret what the founding fathers wrote. The system, for better or worse, works pretty well.
Yeah, it
and
does.
It's really, I can't wait about 15 years, and I hope I'm still around to be able to analyze all this and put it in a historical context, what's going on, because it's really a fascinating time as far as the democracy.
What bothers me is that so many of my colleagues in the media are they're emotional children, really. And I can see from their writing and their tweets, and I tell everybody, read their tweets, not just their commentary.
You know, it's funny you say that, because Eric and I do Cochran Show every Thursday,
right.
And I've been saying this, and he agrees with me for 18 months, if everything is an outrage, then there's nothing's outrageous, meaning and we did this with Clinton, you overreact to everything, then everybody tunes out. The president's approval ratings are the 47-48%, and the more they scream, the more that Robert De Niro gets up and drops the F-bomb, the more that fires up people that in the middle and the right.
I want Maxine Waters. I want her front and center, baby.
Oh,
she's like the perfect
person. You know who I want?
Is that her real hair, though? That's one of the questions I asked in a column last week. What, Jeff? It's beautiful hair. I mean, when I was singing that song to her, "Won't You Be My Neighbor, Maxine," I was thinking about that hair. Is it beautiful or what? Is it real?
Sure. I don't know.
I think the two people you want to see the most of, if you're a Republican, I want Hillary back out too. That's a fundraising machine for us right there.
Jeff, what do you think of Hillary coming out of the woods? Here's like a good. She's in a wooden like a house with big chicken legs. It comes out of the woods like look, and she comes down the stairs with a crooked cane and starts screaming at everybody. What do you think? I just love that. And then Maxine Waters appears.
Yeah.
Like a half centaur Maxine.
But they've so messed this up by her actions and the other things that have gone on. Right now, it's even up. We'll keep the House. We'll keep the Senate. And it's 50-50 we keep the House, which it wasn't three weeks ago.
Jeff Carlin and Pat Brady, got to ask you, the one other aspect of going after Trump, Trump this, Trump that, Trump Russia, Trump Russia, Trump Russia, without any evidence, is that the media has missed the civil war in the Democratic Party.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
A good, bright reader of mine, great reader, he's at IT guy, found a column I had written in 2016 where I said this convulsion is going on the Republican side, but it's too early for the Democratic side. It will come. The same type of convulsion, what we see in the New York Times ignoring of the Crowley race in their own yard, in their own backyard.
They blamed it on Crowley.
They blamed, and the leftist.
She's a
nutty communist, one of those Bernie Sanders people. And, you know, I love you guys. I respect you, but we need borders. And she's like, no borders, no ICE.
Free jobs for everybody.
Free jobs for everybody.
Free health care.
Who's the fascist now?
I know.
Yeah.
Who's going to pay for all that?
The people. When we all work in the government-sponsored factories, wearing the same orange-colored shoes and eating beets.
You know, if you probably
for
saw
dessert.
She, when you watch her, she's very good. I mean, if you believe that, she's very, very good.
Attractive.
Yep, very great articulate, great story.
But what does this mean for the, what is going to happen on the, you know, as we push Jeff Garlin, as the right, I guess, the right is, now, when you see Trump getting support from centrist elements, you can see the party reforming, but on the left, they're having this war. What's going to happen with that war, Jeff Garlin?
Well, I mean, that was a war that was kind of, we saw a glimpse of this in the primary in 2016, leading up to 2016. It's going to be much the same, I think, coming out of November. I mean, I know it's already kind of played some of its way out in the primaries here, but I think we're going to see a lot of the same, where you're going to have new power people coming up. Seemingly socialist, if you're following the trend lines of those who are tweeting and what they're tweeting, and those who are running in the primaries, it's going to be a collapse of the center left, and you see more leftist left, which I didn't think was possible.
You didn't think it was possible?
No,
because they were so far to the left already. I couldn't believe it, and now they're even more.
Bernie Sanders for 20 years has been the wackadoodle on the left. Now he's mainstream Democrat.
So what does that mean for the 2018 election?
It means they will nominate. I don't know who their bench is right now
for 2020, but in 2018, now
2018. I'm sorry,
the midterm.
The midterms on their plus side, they have a lot of energy right now. And in the special elections, they had pretty good turnout. But what's changed in the last 4 or 5 weeks, as the president's numbers have come up, the Republicans' enthusiasm for voting in November is pretty much even with the Democrats. Now, it all depends on who shows up, but it certainly has changed a lot in the last 5-6 weeks.
It has, hasn't it?
Yep.
Because people see, I've heard the right say, this is the most significant midterm election in our history.
And they say that every election.
I know, but I hear who says it, and the guy has an audience of one, really, and he's speaking to Donald Trump on Fox.
Sure.
I don't listen to him, and I don't listen to Rachel Maddow either, unless I want to see good technique on how to fake cry. But it still is. Now we see how significant it
is. For Trump, to me, it's make or break, because the economy's good. We're not at war. We are at war, but not a war that's front and center right now. Then if he loses, though, he's kind of had that bubble of, I haven't lost. If he loses, there's going to be, I think, more of the people on the Republican side, they're going to question his
if he loses and the House gets flips the majority, they're going to impeach him.
I don't think they will.
No, I don't think they want to talk about it.
Yeah. But that's suicide for them.
Suicide, really?
Yeah, I believe that would be such a bad. People, you remember Bill Clinton, all the stuff he did?
Yeah, I wanted him impeached.
And so did I. But
because he was a liar and he didn't have any business being in the presidency.
But politically, when he got impeached, I think he was at 56% and he went out at 58%. I just feel, my own opinion, the general electorate does not like impeachment. I think that'll backfire on him.
Then how does this play in,
and then
gentlemen?
We get Mike Pence. Do they really want Mike Pence?
I wouldn't mind.
I like Mike Pence.
I do too. It would that, though. Given what's going on on the Democratic side with their civil war, and they're moving, you know, they're already, as far as I was concerned, there was no difference between the left and Democrats. And now mainstream Democrats are moving over to the, you know, they're all going to sing the Internationale at their next convention. I don't know how they can complain about Russia with that, but they'll do it. How does that play out in terms of how they address the electorate? I see this as a losing proposition for them.
And it's as much as it's a losing proposition for us to go too far to the right, but the reality is, the way these districts are drawn all over the country, they're very much gerrymandered. So your race is in your primary, and the party goes to the right or to the left, and that's kind of where you're stuck. There are very few swing districts left anymore, or swing seats.
One of them, I would think, would be the 3rd Illinois district, the last of the moderate Democrats, regular Democrats.
But he beat back that he. I was actually surprised he won that, and he won it fairly easily.
Yeah, the hard left came after him there. Yeah. But what's interesting to me,
he got a Nazi on the ballot.
How did that happen? Okay, you know, here's my problem with the Republican Party, a party I used to like, and I left. They don't pay attention to what their business. I just can't understand how you can have a, I didn't want to say his name, but a repulsive Nazi running.
Not just he's a real Nazi, not a, yeah. He's yeah, a Nazi.
Right, Jeff?
Holocaust denier, yeah. And like, to the, just, he, but the stuff he puts out and he forwards and regurgitates from other places, it's just appalling.
I don't remember his name.
It's like,
I would
Alex
only say
Jones
name.
Don't care his name.
Yeah,
I mean,
to tell everybody to not vote for him. And part of it is, too, he signed his petitions. But yeah, it's not a good thing. I don't think anybody thinks
so. What does that say about the Republican Party that allowed that to happen locally?
I'm sure that the chairman of their party, I think, is a great guy. He's done a great job.
Tim Snyder, yeah.
Yeah, he's really been a good chairman. And I'm sure he's like kicking himself, too. But I think one thing about being party chairman that I was for almost 5 years,
right.
You're not as powerful or involved in everything as maybe the Madigan Mapes people are. You just don't have the resources. It's a volunteer job. Nobody's defending it, and we just got to make sure that Dan Lipinski wins.
On the other side, and that's my pitch for bipartisanship, I'm going to support Dan Lipinski.
I like Dan Lipinski.
He's a neighbor, okay? Yeah, he's down the street. I always liked him. You can deal I liked with. His father.
Yeah.
I like him. And I like the fact that they built that, Jeff, they built that underpass. Federal money came to build an underpass on 71st Street so John Cass can get to the soccer games at Toyota Park without having to wait for the train.
So nice of him.
That
so
294 nice. Thing's going to be big out there, too. Are you going to get a bathroom out there?
I don't like the 294. I think, any, you know, like, doesn't Palumbo and Pelote and all those guys, don't they have enough? Come on, man.
You need to
come
expand on, it, though. Man. It's a mess.
Let's get back to the politics. Rauner wins Janus. I wrote a column before the election, before the race, last Sunday, or the Sunday before the justices decided it. I kind of figured, and so did you, right, Pat? And I said, should this be Bruce Rauner's legacy? And I think even though he's gotten criticism, and I have friends on the conservative side, and I'm conservative, they don't want to give him credit. John Tillman, to his credit, Illinois Policy Institute,
well, the governor's
was there.
Credit too, because there was some bad language back. On
they,
both
they
sides.
Had, yeah, they had, yeah. They had their spats.
Yeah.
But John Tillman got together with him, and they were both on the Supreme Court steps. I got to think it's going to be a tough race against Pritzker, given what happened in the past. The House Bill 40, the sanctuary state thing, whatever you want to call it. He lost conservatives. Can this Janus thing help focus the people's minds on what's really going on in terms of the politics of the state?
Yeah, I absolutely believe that. And the governor actually had a pretty good fight, really good 5 or 6 weeks. Got a budget done, got Janus. Government's fully funded and operating. He's been on message. And I think people, like you said, with the Policy Institute that went to war with the governor, went to war with me, and I went to war with them. I think everybody is coalescing now, realizing what the stakes are. And you have to look at J.B. Pritzker, who has, and you can, Democrats will tell you this, why is he running for governor?
Because he could buy it.
But what's his agenda? I'm going to raise your taxes. He was on Cochran the other day and was asked about what he wants to do to fix the number one issue in the state, the pension problem. He filibustered for 40 seconds, then Cochran asked him again. And he said, well, I think we need to flatten out the actuarial tables, which to me is you're going to make your grandkids pay for it. It's accounting speak, and it's not a solution. This is a guy that spent $100 million to be at 36%, and his message is we need to protect our values. And this is the guy who ripped toilets out of his house to save – he's a multi-billionaire to save $230,000. So I think – listen, this thing 8 weeks, 9 weeks ago, I think a lot of people had written the governor off. This is – right now it's
– I wrote him off.
Yeah, it's game on now. The people are – I guess when to answer your question – people, conservatives, people that care about fiscal issues in this state, understand that J.B. Pritzker is Mike Madigan's political godson. Nothing's going to change. There's name me one thing that he's going to do to reform this state. He he hasn't talked about it in a year and a half.
When Mike opened the, you know, because sometimes he does that, the Khan of Medaganistan will allow the people of Illinois to vote. And when he started this campaign, Jeff Garland, he basically put out the word to all these Democrats, whoever wins, whoever wants to win, better bring some money.
Right.
Because this is about funding not only your own race, but all of Mike's races, especially now that if they can't take union money from, if they can't squeeze money from the public workers unions, and that's going to start dropping
immediately
because of Janus, they're going to need more money from Pritzker. You think he can ask his sister to come in and kick some?
It's amazing that a guy that has spent $100 million already to be at 36%, and he has ads everywhere on digital or cable TV or internet TV.
Yeah, yeah.
And I watch his ads and go, you know what? You're not that likable.
I can't even watch, like, Westworld. Jeff, I can't even go, like, look for Westworld, you know, hints to find out what the hell's going on in that weird show without getting a J.B. Pritzker ad.
And this is what you should put in your head when you see him. He's going to raise your taxes.
Oh, yeah.
He's going to raise your taxes. That's, you can say that again and again and again. And he doesn't care at all about the taxpayers of the state. He gets to be governor and go around and go to the North Shore parties and talk about the little people. But this guy is what is wrong with the state. It's the elitist know-it-alls that think that this is just kind of fun and games. He has no agenda at all. You can criticize the governor all you want, but he's run on an agenda. He's got 44 things he wants to get done, and Janus was one of the big ones, and he got it done. JB has nothing to run on.
Here's a scary thing to test. You can do at home. Just pull up a Google browser in our search bar and just type in the word Browner and just hit search. And the first thing that'll come up will be a paid ad from J.B. Pritzker. That'll be the top of your search queue, and it'll say, you know, sponsored. And those ads to be at the top of a queue across the board for just one word or just one phrase that says tied to Rauner. And you can search any Rauner phrase, and that'll always be on top. They go to Google and they say, hey, we want this ad to be at the top thing people see. And they pay for that headline ad to run that little box that has above your search, all your queue results, your query results.
So they push it up.
Right. And so they pay a lot of money.
So like Edwin Eisendrath's Reader. Which is like, you know, the Reader, the Sun-Times was, you know, basically the chairman of the Sun-Times, Jorge Ramirez, a decent guy, AFL-CIO boss, investor in the Sun-Times, now working for Michael Sachs, the mayor's money guy. And they had the Reader do it. I don't know if they did it personally, but the Reader, when they owned it, did a story that says, Cass sucks. He's one of the worst. He's the worst columnist in the history of columns. He sucks.
That was a
big
great
fed.
Article.
Yeah, wasn't it? Wasn't it? The only thing that was missing was the picture of a chunk of my back hair. Anyway,
thought about you the other day. Did you see
push
the back
that
shaver?
Up? What?
There's an ad nice, on now yeah. for a back shaver.
Can I get it? The thing is, I got short arms.
That's, so it's designed for that.
Have you seen it, Jeff?
Does it have a long stem on it?
Yeah, it's like a loofah kind of thing, like a big long, you know, those old back scratching washer things.
Jeff,
it's got
you're the burly Jeff Carlin. If anyone's seen him in his pictures,
I would like one. That's
you know,
on my
Jeff
list.
Grows a beard in like one half an hour.
Every time I come in here, he's got his beard.
Doesn't he?
Oh, that's amazing.
He shaved his beard off. It's growing back now.
I know.
By the time the end of this podcast, he's going to have half a beard already.
He's a manly man.
Do you ever use that thing, Jeff?
I it's on my list. I got a half birthday coming up.
Speaking of shaving, I think you want to shave Bruce Rauner just a little bit with some. What was it? Rauner showed up on Rokan, right?
Yeah, he stopped by. We were we didn't broadcast this podcast. He came on our show, and here's the audio of him talking about trying to create development in tech sector in Illinois and where he would do that and how trying to do it around the schools is important, but a lot of the students end up leaving. And here's the question.
Are we going to be able to keep up with the 21st century science, technology, engineering, and math needs?
Yes, great question. I think that's the number one question for our economy. We have huge potential in Illinois to very quickly accelerate our pace of growth, and I'm super excited about it. You know, the great thing about Illinois is our people. We have the best workforce in the world right here, such hardworking, dedicated people and workforce, well-educated, very highly productive. Companies want to come here. We do need to get some regulatory relief. We do need to bring down our tax burden. But one of the most exciting things we can do, and it's within our power, we're beginning now, is to make sure that we invest in the technology and innovation sector. That's where the economic growth is. California's booming. Seattle's booming. Right. New York, Boston, Research Triangle, North Carolina, booming because of the tech sector. And in all those areas, the driver of that tech sector is the university system. It's Harvard and MIT. It's Stanford and Berkeley.
Some of the best in the world.
We do.
With that, what's holding us back?
Well, the tragedy for us in Illinois is the University of Illinois is here, one of the greatest research universities in the world, and their students have started many of the greatest companies in the world. Oracle, PayPal, YouTube, Tesla Motors, iTunes. It's stunning.
Right.
None of them are in Illinois. And there's several reasons, but part of the reason is Champaign-Urbana is wonderful, but it's very hard to keep a company of more than six people there. There's no convenient transportation, not much of a workforce, and it's very hard. We can start some companies there, but what we need to do is help the University of Illinois expand in Chicago, expand into Rockford and Peoria that have large economic systems and great companies already.
Airports and rail and all that.
Exactly. Okay. And a diverse, large workforce, and then use their innovation and technology ability, get their students integrated in the local economy, and we can boom. And if we get the U of I to open a campus here down on Roosevelt Road, which is what we're striving to do, and get them to partner with U of C, Northwestern, Tel Aviv University, and Technion in Israel, they're new partners for this, we can have some of the greatest innovation and some of the fastest growing companies right here in the state of Illinois.
So what's the beef?
Well, the beef is that he said not much of a workforce, and so they took it as a shot. Yeah,
not much. He's saying that you can't bring big companies there because they can't handle the.
There's not a population. I mean, the economy is built around the schools, and the people who are working there are working for the schools or related fields, and so they say that there isn't a pool of people to hire from because people go to learn and then leave. That was his point.
Who's latching on to that
reporter down there?
Yeah.
He got all over it.
Mark Maxwell.
Come on, Mark, man.
This unfortunate choice of words. I think he walked it back a little bit and said, he did. You know what I meant. I mean, I grew up downstate, and there is a problem downstate with economic development. And it's, if any more of these companies pull out, it's going to be nothing but prisons and universities. So south of I-80 to all the way to the bottom of the state.
I thought the only economic development was John Cass losing money at the pool halls down there.
Well, here's a question for you guys, though. So that was podcasted. That went up on Friday. That wasn't broadcast. So somebody, I mean, that was a deep dive to get that audio. And I know I'm not saying we're not listened to, but, you know, we put it up on at like 5 o'clock on Friday.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like it was caught on someone's ears in real time. We didn't run it in a newscast here. So I find that very interesting that was latched onto by anybody, especially a reporter who's probably already taxed to covering 1,000 other things.
Well, this is Oppo Research, my principal.
Right.
They follow everything he says. I assume they have trackers.
Yeah, I'm sure they do. But I just, you know, we wouldn't have it if it weren't. If that was an election year, I don't think anybody would have caught that.
You don't think that they track this show?
This show.
The Chicago way? I can see Rahm sitting in his little, you know, in Union Pier with the, you know, he's got the boat shoes on, no socks, and the pants, you know, the white pants and the blazer, just like he wore to a fireman's funeral.
Chuck.
Okay? He wore to firefighter's funeral without shine black shoes. This freaked out half of the Democrats I know in Chicago.
Socks.
No socks. Yeah, but I'm sure he's listening.
That's a bad luck over 8 years old.
For Pat Brady, I think after this podcast, we have to go to lunch.
I got to get back and discipline children. We had a bed count didn't match the inmate count this morning. Get some kids to chase.
Yeah, there's nothing like teenagers.
Well, you know, college kids.
You just start, what you do is you start shaking the keys. Well, they don't care about keys now. They have cars.
You know what I do every morning? I get up super early just because I do. I run around the house at 4:45 screaming, thank God I'm a country boy. John Denver song.
Yeah.
I scream it. Got me bad.
Nothing like fatherhood, Pat Brady.
It's all good.
All right. For Pat
thank
Brady.
You. Happy 4th, everybody. Thank you, buddy.
All right, bud.
See ya.
Well, on the farm, it's kind of laid back. Ain't much an old country boy like me can't hack. It's early to rise, early in the sack. I thank God I'm a country boy. Well, a simple kind of life never did me no harm. Raising me a family and working on the farm. Days are all filled with an easy country charm. Thank God I'm a country boy. Well, I got me a fine wife, I got me old fiddle. When the sun's coming up, I got cakes on the griddles. Life ain't nothing but a funny.
Joining us now on the Chicago Way is John Tillman, CEO and founder of the Illinois Policy Institute. John, the Policy Institute had a tremendous and important role in the Janus decision. They basically were the drivers for it. And even though in the past the IPI and Governor Rauner were at odds over other policy and politics, on this one they came together on the steps of the Supreme Court when Janus was announced. What is all
this
about?
It was a great day, John, and the governor and I were together along with Mark Janus. We sat in the court for 3 days in a row. Monday and Tuesday, our case did not come down, but of course, we knew it would come down on Wednesday, which was the last day of the court session. And I have to say, as Justice Alito started reading the opinion, you could feel the excitement in the governor, who was sitting next to me, and Mark Janus, who was sitting next to him. We, all three of us, been a long journey, 3 years of trying to get to this point, and Mark Janus is the true hero of the whole thing. He's really done a great job. But the governor started the case. And then we picked it up when he got bounced from it because he didn't have standing, but he had the vision to start it. We had the wherewithal to finish it through our litigation center, or Liberty Justice Center. But the most important thing is Mark was a closer and stayed with it all the way through.
What does it mean for the people of Illinois and the rest of the country? It's a freedom of speech case. Justice Kennedy, who is, if nothing, an advocate of the First Amendment.
Justice Kennedy's history has been as a great advocate of the First Amendment, and people have some quibbles, obviously, on other areas of his jurisprudence, but in this area, he's been fantastic. And what it means, John, for the people of Illinois is that the playing field will start to level out a little bit. The unions, the government unions here in Illinois, have had monopoly control over their workers as to whether or not they could exercise their free speech rights. If you were working for government and you were in a union, the union had the right to take money from you, and if you opted out of the union, they still took about 80% of the dues from you that they claimed was for collective bargaining. And of course, the ruling on Wednesday basically said that everything the union does is inherently political, since the union employees are paid by taxpayer dollars.
Right.
And so now workers who want to opt out won't have to pay anything. And with the opt-in provision that Justice Alito added, it means that it's very explicit now that individual members must explicitly opt in to a union. And what that means, in our view, is that going forward, from this point forward, every single union is going to have to re-ask every single member to rejoin.
What are the politics of all this? I know that you're talking policy and what's right and wrong for the, you know, in terms of the right and wrong of things, but the politics of this, how does this play out?
Well, the politics of this, the most powerful political force in the state of Illinois for years has been AFSCME, which is the American Federation of County, State, and Municipal Employees. It's the largest union in the state, about 35,000 members. Also, the SEIU, another big state union. Of course, the teachers, the Illinois Education Association, Chicago Teachers Union, and so forth. Illinois Federation of Teachers. These are the most powerful political forces in the state. And the reason they're the most powerful political forces in the state is because they have so much money to spend. They're the biggest spenders by far in state politics. And so what this will do is level the playing field so that those employees who decide they don't agree with the positions of their union can opt out and obviously keep the money for themselves, for their family. And those who love the union and believe in what the union has to say can still opt in and support that work. But it'll start to level the playing field, and I think we'll get a more competitive political landscape over time.
One of the some of the research that I read, I found it also in Mother Jones or The Nation, and then, you know, on the left side and went into it. You see a drop when public worker unions cannot coerce money from their membership. You see a drop of, according to these studies, between 3% and 5% in the ballot on the Democratic side. That's huge for legislative races.
It's huge, and I think people should process that information carefully. Of course, those were progressive think tanks who came up with those numbers, so yes. It's interesting to me that they are fearful of this. But what it really says is that for all of these years, the progressive side and the union position has had an artificial advantage of 3 to 5%. That's what it really is saying. They've had an artificial advantage because of the coercive nature of labor law, which forced non-members to continue to pay the unions. And once that ends, what it means is that things revert back to the normal level, and you see those numbers drop 3 to 5%. So it does have a political impact in that sense. But I think the more important thing we should always keep our eye on is that this case was a free speech case. This was an empowering workers with a simple question. Should you be in charge of your relationship with your union and your free speech rights? Or should the union still have control over your speech rights? And the court ruled that the individual worker should control their speech rights. It has downstream consequences that you just mentioned, but let's remember always that it's a free speech case first and foremost.
So how does this apply to the Chicago Teachers Union, let's say?
That means every single teacher, as of Wednesday, will now have to opt in to the union affirmatively and clearly. That is explicitly what the case says. Now, the unions, of course, are taking a very different position. Their position is that all the opt-ins where people signed up for the union in the past count and carry forward past this decision on Wednesday. Right. We reject that notion. We think that is wrong. And the reason it's wrong is because anybody that opted in, they opted in under different conditions when their free speech rights were being oppressed, as the court ruled. And so those conditions no longer apply. And I think we expect to see some action and some litigation on this very quickly.
Clearly, you're also involved in politics, even though you're a policy guy. But I wonder what it means for Rauner. I've been highly critical of the governor in the column for abandoning conservatives on the sanctuary city policy, for changing his mind and betraying them on the House Bill 40, for compelling taxpayers to basically pay for abortion on demand, which I thought was a betrayal of the conservative groups. How does this Janus thing give him an entree back into the gubernatorial race?
Well, I think it absolutely does. And to clarify just a couple things, of course, when I have my Illinois Policy Institute hat on, I focus strictly on policy, but I'm, as we like to joke, John the Citizen, and I still get to participate in politics as John the Citizen. So I'll kind of blend the two different thoughts here on that, because I think it's an important question that you've just asked, John. The thing about the governor, and, you know, I've had my differences with him, but I've always said and made this very clear, I'm here about the policy. I want to advance a policy agenda that empowers people to live more fulfilling lives with greater personal prosperity in terms of material sense, but also greater prosperity in a sense of the human spirit. And that's all I really care about. And in this case, this governor has done something that is extraordinary. He took the initiative to start a case, and then we finished that case with Mark Janus being the plaintiff in it, and Mark really driving the truck and us doing the legal work. But the governor had to be. So no one person creates transformational change. It took a lot of people to make this happen, especially Mark Janus. So everybody gets a little bit of credit, and especially Mark. But the governor certainly should take his credit and have pride in that. It's a great legacy for him. And some people have criticized me for saying that, but I've always said it's about the policy, and he deserves credit for this. And I do think it will help him in the election, because it really shows that he's on the worker side. He's on the side. He's not anti-union. Neither am I. Neither are you. It's about letting the worker choose.
Oh, I'm apparently in one, whether I like to be or not.
You know, you can opt out, John. You don't have to.
We'll have a discussion. We'll see who's the next. If Ben Shapiro is nominated to the Supreme Court, as I hope, for 40 years, we'll have an originalist or Orthodox Jewish guy.
Wouldn't that be amazing?
I would love that.
Is he an attorney? I didn't even know if he's an attorney. You don't have to be an attorney to be a Supreme Court
He
justice.
Is an attorney. I think he graduated, graduated from Harvard when he was 12 or something like that.
Oh, my God. He is amazing.
Jeff, what do you think? What do you think of all this? You're hearing us talk. What do you think?
Well, I mean, as someone who I wasn't a public sector union, but when I was in younger days, I worked for out at Arlington Racetrack, and that's a union shop. And as a kid, I remember, you know, I'd have to pay $90 plus $100 every year just to work there and be part of the union. But I was on like a 90-day you know, probationary period, but the track meet was only 90 days. So it didn't really matter. I had no power. I had nothing. There was no value for me other than I made a pretty good rate, but I didn't get any benefits, but I was forced to pay. And it translates. I mean, I see this clearly that this is totally a free speech thing because I don't want to have that union working on my behalf or doing anything on my behalf because I can do that on my own. I don't need that, and I should be able to choose. So I think it's really interesting. But John, do you think it's going to have any impact or on the underlying debts that are weighing down our state and that are mostly going towards union pieces? Do you think this is going to weaken unions in the future? And do you think the way that SCOTUS is going to shake up, it might help the state at some point down the line?
I think it's going to be a little bit complex and take a little bit of time to work itself out. But I think what is going to happen over time is that the unions have had an artificial, as I said earlier, a political advantage. And as a result of them losing that artificial political advantage, I think we're going to see Illinois become much more competitive politically. Maybe not right away in 2018, although I think it's going to go better than people think in 2018. But in future election cycles, I think you're going to see our two-party system reemerge as a very competitive environment. And I think once you have political competition and Speaker Madigan doesn't have the domineering control he currently has, and because he is beholden completely to the unions, they provide him with about $30-ish million every election. Once he doesn't have that monopoly control of them and the Republican side is more able to compete, I think we are much more likely to see some of the policy changes that are necessary in the public finance, such as pension reform, post-employment benefits and ongoing benefits for current workers, as well as just the entire regulatory environment and the hostility to entrepreneurship and business in Illinois as compared to, say, Iowa or Indiana. I think that we'll see improvements on all of that, which will be helpful.
You know, guys, for me, I'm not against the unions, but I've seen the corrupt nature of this symbiotic predatory relationship on Illinois. The unions have the money, and they've put 40,000-50,000 troops boots on the ground during elections for Madigan. Madigan then raises taxes on us to pay for his power relationship. It's Franklin Delano Roosevelt, one of our most, I think probably the most pro-labor president in the history of the United States, saw the conflict and was worried about this relationship. And I think that, to me, it's like it could be a truly transformative moment in Illinois as we keep losing jobs and businesses and people to other states.
Yeah, and it's going to change not just Illinois. It affects 22 states, and a lot of those states affected are big blue states, New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, California. These are all places, 22 states, where the blue state paradigm dominates and public sector unions dominate. And I think you're going to really see some changes. If you look at what's happened in Michigan and Wisconsin and Indiana and Iowa as they let their workers control their destiny and had worker freedom, it really changed the nature of the states and the politics. And those states are all just killing it in terms of economic growth, job growth, wage growth, and all the rest of it. So I think that everybody from the union point of view wants to talk about how terrible it's going to be, but we have many examples around the country where similar policies have gone into place, and it's gone extremely well, and I'm very optimistic that can happen here. And the other thing, John, I think that I know you and I have talked about in the past is we're talking, of course, about government unions. And the government is monopoly provider of services, and the union becomes monopoly provider of labor, and that's why Roosevelt opposed it. In the private sector, union members, their businesses that they work for have to compete with other business all around the world. And so it's not the same thing, and that's why the private sector is not the problem that the public sector is.
Exactly. And we're not talking about private. We're not talking about plumbers. We're not talking about carpenters.
Nope.
None of that.
Nope.
The one thing that is interesting is that Justice Kennedy is retiring. He was pro-First Amendment 100%. Appointed by Ronald Reagan. When he was appointed, there was all the controversy over Justice Bork and others, but still liberals pulled their hair out and screamed, oh my God, a conservative president putting a conservative. And look what happened. He supported Roe v. Wade, which I still don't know how that was done, how you find penumbra in the Constitution, but he did. And he supported also gay rights, gay marriage, same-sex marriage, things that the religious community oppose. But this came from a conservative justice, right? So what do you make of the, what do you make of the hysteria now? The hysteria on the left.
I think what's so funny about watching how they treat Kennedy, and a little bit with Justice Roberts when it was the Obamacare case, but using Kennedy as the particular example, boy, do they love him when he's on their side, and boy, do they revile him when he's not. So on all those cases you talked about, the abortion issue and gay marriage, which, to be clear, are issues the Illinois Policy Institute doesn't get into, but I love to talk about because it's fun. They loved him then. But boy, when he applies free speech rules and religious freedom rules to people who, for example, he was obviously on the side of the majority on the free speech and religious freedom issue in California.
Yes.
So now they hate him. And so it just shows you that, you know, I think Kennedy, despite all the criticisms from him on the right, he has carved out a pretty clear track record of what he's going to do. He's going to be very consistent on free speech, freedom of religion, and he's going to be very consistent on what we'll call social issues that he has a more liberal view. And, you know, both sides get a little something they like and both sides get a little something they don't.
Here's my problem with that as we wrap up. The Supreme Court has way too much power. If the entire country goes to the Supreme Court, oh my, like as if they're gods on high, and one vote is in the balance, and that this dictates, to me that's much too much power. But what I'm seeing is from the left, and not to condemn them or my colleagues, and God knows I'm an outnumbered minority there.
You're your last man standing, John.
I'm floating on the sugar cookie in the sea of liberal milk, John Tillman. But what I see them do constantly is push an agenda, like say the court should be for gay marriage, or the court should be for unions or not, or they should be against. It depends on the politics of the time. If someone comes in, another group comes in, another politic changes, and we have the French Revolution to come, and we say everyone should have their head. Whatever we want, we demand from the Supreme Court in terms of agenda. But where are the people saying, let's just read the Constitution as written and talk about the original intent, and that alone will protect us from demagogues, from so-called Hitlers or dictators, that alone will protect us.
That's exactly right. And the reason the originalist approach is so much better than the concept that the left loves of a living constitution is the point you just made. When you have, the hot fires of politics, and look what's going on with what they're doing to Sarah Sanders and the Homeland Security Secretary and driving people out of restaurants while eating meals. I mean, the incivility of public discourse and public debate now is really incredible. And if you start to take that all the way to the Supreme Court, and it's all about intimidation and frightening people, pretty soon are they going to start to intimidate the justices of the Supreme Court? What if it was people on the right who are intimidating Ruth Bader Ginsburg or Sotomayor and all the rest? Nobody would stand for that. We have to go back to where we have civil discourse and not what I'll call the tyranny of the left on some of these things. It's really disturbing.
I think everybody should go back in history, read about the Fond, and read about the war in France when Versailles fell and the heads were cut off, because I'm literally going to push this. We should read our history, and we should see it. We should note what happens when the mob gains control, and why our founders understood human nature, and they understood that men will fall to low levels if we don't have a system that protects them from not the better angels of our nature, but the worst.
Well, and that's why the originalist approach is the right one, because it's about the rule of law, not the rule of man, and hot passions running hot at a given moment in time.
And with that, I can't think of a better way out. That from John Tillman should be carved into the walls of the new Chicago Tribune lobby, wherever it is, and someday I'll visit it. For John Tillman, CEO of the Illinois Policy Institute, and for Pat Brady of the Next Generation Strategies, and for Jeff Carlin, from WGN Radio and my good friend and pie baker, but he hasn't baked me a pie yet this year. And for me, John Cass, syndicated columnist, Tribune, the conservative on the sugar cookie in a sea of liberal milk, seeing the edges crumble all around me every day. This has been another edition of the Chicago Way.